Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I want to thank you for joining us for this special edition of the podcast, COVID-19, Assessing the Impacts on the Food Industry. Well, first and foremost, we hope that you're well and successfully meeting the challenges presented by the virus both personally and professionally. We're offering this special edition today in the hopes that a discussion of the implications of the coronavirus on the food industry, and specifically any food safety implications, will be helpful to you. While we know that the coronavirus is not transferred via food, we know that there is increased and shifting demands on the industry. And all this puts stress on our food safety programs, from inputs through transportation and retail food service operations. To help us, we reached out to two experts in strategic planning, emergency response, and crisis management for supply chains. So today, you'll be hearing Barbara's discussion with John Keough and Carl, or CJ, Eunice. John Keough is a strategist, advisor, and management science researcher with 30 years of executive leadership roles as director, vice president, and senior vice president in global supply chain management, information technology, technology consulting, and supply chain standards. Currently, he is managing principal at Toronto-based niche advisory and research firm Shantala. He holds a postgraduate diploma in management and a Master of Science in Business and Management Research in Transparency and Trust in the Food Chain. He is currently completing doctoral research focused on transparency and trust in global food chains at Henley Business School at the University of Reading using the lenses of agency theory, signaling theory, and transactional cost theory. Carl, or CJ Eunice, is a systems engineer with expertise in continuity of operations, continuity of government, devolution, infrastructure, supply chain logistics, and emergency management. He has a master's degree in systems engineering from the Stevens Institute of Technology. CJ was formerly the Critical Infrastructure Protection Program Manager for the New Mexico Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He served as a federal agent in the capacity of providing classified transportation for the Department of Energy, National Nuclear Security Administration, Office of Secure Transportation, as well as holding numerous positions for the U.S. Marine Corps in the capacity of performing internal embassy, dignitary, motor transport specialist, and classified material security duties. As always, we hope that you find value in this discussion. And here it is now.
I first want to welcome John and CJ to the podcast today, and thank you both for making yourselves available on such short notice for this important discussion. We want to help calm the waters and help those in the food industry navigate this crisis. We want to figure out where we are and where we need to go. So, being that both of you come from military background, here we are in the wartime mindset, the middle of a crisis. So, John, if we could start with you, should we have seen this pandemic coming?
Great question, Barbara. Absolutely. I believe we should have seen it coming. But before I get into the answer, let me just give a shout out to all of those people who are working in the factories and in kitchens of restaurants and in all of the healthcare as well, keeping us safe and keeping us fed, driving those trucks. Up here in Canada, we're very dependent on U.S. supply of fruit and vegetables. So, first off, a shout out to all the people who do tremendous work in these difficult circumstances. Now, should we have seen it coming? Absolutely, yes. In 2006, Dr. Larry Brilliant, after smallpox eradication, he warned that this is going to come again very quickly. And he also warned that the way to solve these major issues, you go from outbreak to epidemic to pandemic, and the difference is scale. So when you get an outbreak, what he talked about and he guided us in 2006 after SARS is that early detection, early response is critical to solving this and inhibiting it to move from an outbreak up to an epidemic and a pandemic. So that early detection, early response is absolutely critical. So should we see it coming? Absolutely. In 2007, Chinese scientists based in Hong Kong said it's a ticking time bomb in the wet markets across Asia, and in particular in southern China. So they warned us again in 2007. When you look at planning within the food chain and the consumer goods chain, and in food in particular, I think we're missing a skill set. And we're missing the skill set that CJ and I have from our military background, and it's planning in peacetime for wartime crisis situations. So that's, I'm not talking about military leadership per se, but I'm talking about how do you plan in peacetime for something that could happen, may never happen, but if it does happen, are you ready to go? And I think that skill set is a critical missing factor. If you go on to, you know, how could we change this? How could we recover from this? We have a long road to go. One of the bigger issues that I see right now in the conversations yesterday, I was on the phone for about 10 hours here in Canada. And it's very, very simple. It's very easy to look back and say, you know what? We actually haven't digitized our supply chain like we should have. So that's one of the key issues that's inhibiting the sharing of inventories right now and getting good visibility on where products are. We have enough products in the supply chain. The big food companies like Mondelez and Campbell's Soup, you know, Campbell's Soup demand is up 60% for their soup. It's up 20% for Goldfish. So people want comfort foods as well and chocolates in a time of crisis. But they're able to handle this elasticity in their supply chain when the demand curve goes up very high. They're able to deal with that. The issue is how long will the crisis last? And if the crisis lasts longer than a three-month window, then we're talking about potential issues with ingredients that may inhibit the supply chain. And if I just finish on this one, in British Columbia and Canada, the government stepped in last night and said, we're taking control of supply chains. And that's a black mark on not only the industry, but also consumer behavior. Industry was not capable of protecting the supply or the equitable distribution of products. And consumers went in and they were buying pallets full of products, the utilitarian products like toilet paper and sanitization goods and so on. And now you see those people are bad actors and doing price gouging online. So a lot has to happen. What happened in BC, maybe that will happen in other areas as well. I think in Canada, we may see military leadership coming in and taking control of supply chains, possibly because that skill set is missing in industry.
You know, CJ, John just mentioned digitization of the supply chain, and, you know, supply chain architecture is one of your fortes. So can you help us understand how the architecture of this food supply is working now and what needs to happen as we move through this pandemic and out the other side?
Barbara, that's a great segue. And John, thank you for that insight, because I think we've got a lot of things that kind of need to be flushed out here, bigger picture. The current supply chain, and we've discussed this, the supply isn't necessarily the issue. The distribution network is the challenge. And there are plenty of folks that have said, we have an issue with the way in which goods and services or the distribution network is delivered or is currently designed. And those things are currently designed for a quote unquote blue sky day. What I mean by blue sky day is these systems are designed under normal designed for normal operations. And the problem that you run into is we are far, far from what anyone considered to be normal operations right now. The blue sky would be this: the system's design is occurring for what we see during a normal time. So I'm repeating myself here because I'm thinking through this process, because we have a major issue right now. We have consumers that are purchasing 3 to 5 times normally what they would normally consume, which is causing disruptions and unintended consequences throughout the distribution network. So therein lies a lot of the problems. So initially, I'm starting to see the system catch back up here locally in New Mexico, but I don't know what the rest of the country looks like. I don't know if people are still having issues. Some of the major epicenters of, you know, New York and California, where the disease is spreading, could still potentially be an issue. So, I mean, these are important things, but we also have to look at the system, at the as-is system and the potential to-be system that we kind of want to reinvent, per se, after this is over with, because we have to consider creating potential buffer zones in the system that are good. So I can give it back to John to elaborate on other things, but that's kind of my thought with that, Barbara, if there's anything else that you'd like me to elaborate on as well.
What do you think is the biggest vulnerability in the architecture as it exists right now? What is some low-hanging fruit that we can't even wait till we get to the other side until we need to change it? Is there anything that qualifies?
I would have to say education on the system's architecture, because a lot of the food distribution folks understand their portion of how their system works, but there's interconnected complexity within that architecture, and there's cross-sector vulnerabilities, there's single points of failure, the distribution network is a problem. What I mean by cross-sector vulnerabilities is there may be, you know, one part of the industry that's indirectly connected to another part of the industry, and now you're starting to talk about multidimensional problems that fundamentally scare folks, because people don't necessarily, people are afraid of what they don't understand. And I see that in supply chains, in systems architecture, and a lot of things where they have this, you know, throw it over the fence mentality, and they don't want to understand. They understand their world and how it works, but they don't necessarily understand, you know, three levels up or four levels down in the logistical supply chain or the systems architecture that's necessarily in creating a whole systems of systems architecture. Does that help?
Yeah. So can you give like a basic example for our listeners to like illustrate this?
Sure. So distribution network. So you've got rail cars bringing in raw materials to make a certain product or service. Those raw materials are then brought into the factories. The factories then process it with a multitude of different ingredients. Trucks bring in other raw materials and ingredients to create a complete product. When there are disruptions in the supply chain of those products cannot be manufactured as a result of the logistics or supply chain disruptions for those types of things, which is 95% of the food industry is logistics based. So when there are disruptions in the food supply chain, you have potential single points of failure for a certain product that's coming in either through Canada or through Mexico, depending on what needs to happen to make a complete product. There are cascading internal failures within a systems enterprise, or there are potential unintended consequences of certain things not being made available to folks. And, you know, what John had mentioned earlier with governments taking over supply chains, the potential unintended consequences and the potential disruptions to those things could be potentially catastrophic.
So many questions to ask the two of you. Let's go back to John for a minute. John, you mentioned the need for leadership right now. What are the characteristics that are really needed to help get us back to a new normal?
Yeah, that's a great question. Leadership, of course, is interpreted in many different ways, but when you're in a crisis, whether it's a military crisis or a public order crisis, I've also reserve police background, it's you need someone to take control of the situation, and that someone that takes control needs to be able to make decisions based on the information they have. So what we talk about is speed over accuracy, and this is very, very important. You cannot go on the merry-go-round and go around in circles. You have to make decisions. So key to leadership, effective leadership, is making decisions. We often call that adopt and go. In other words, if you have three options that are similar, instead of spending 3 days or 4 days weighing up those options against each other, pick one of them and go with it, get a consensus and move with that. So speed over accuracy or speed over precision is absolutely critical. The other part of leadership in any crisis is triage. And we know triage from any emergency, right? You don't want to be working on a patient if they're already dead, right? So we talk about in proper triage, breathing, bleeding, and breaks in that order. So this reflects back to the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Do people have homes to live in? What is the risk with people being kicked out of their houses? So in Canada, we have almost a moratorium that nobody will be evicted from their homes for not paying their rent or their mortgage for the next 6 months. So the government has stepped in, that's good political leadership, and said that will not happen. The government has also stepped in again on the other side of Maslow. They have enough food, and they have food, they have shelter, and they have medicines and the essentials. So that's another part of triage. And in that triage, you have to set priorities. So for example, if you go into the industry, some of the big food companies may need to make decisions. And this is leadership as well. If you make 10 versions of the same product, and you know that you could be running out of one of the ingredients critical to all 10 of them in the next 3 months, a leadership decision from a food company could be, you know what, let's cut that down to just two products. And for the next 3 months, we'll produce more of those two products and get them out to the market rather than having 10 different flavors. And I think that's leadership as well. Leadership is also listening. So when the borders closed in most countries, and I'll look at Canada here now in particular, the borders closed, but the farmers put up their hand and said, hey, you know what? We're just a few weeks away from, or a month away from seeding, and we need the foreign migrant workers. So we need about 60,000 in Canada and about 20,000 in Ontario alone. So if they don't get the migrant workers in, then they're stuck. We're not going to have crops in the summer, right? And in Ontario, we have corn. Well, guess what? I was on some calls yesterday, and we were going around in circles. And again, talk about leadership. There was a lot of focus on, well, let's look at the distribution of the products out to the retail stores and make sure we have enough products. And then I reminded them that we have to also go back up the food chain to look at the primary producers. In Ontario, we produce primarily corn. So, and what I had to remind them is that 3,000 products in the grocery store in Canada have corn as an ingredient. So you'd be defeating the purpose if you're only focused on the sellable product and not on the primary production side. From a wheat perspective, you know, there's 13,000 products worldwide registered as whole wheat. 70% of those, or 10,000, are in North America. So we have 3,000 products in Canada alone that have corn as an ingredient, 10,000 products that have whole wheat as an ingredient in North America. And then on top of that, you'd have, you know, gluten-free and so on. So leadership is looking at the big picture as well and tying it end-to-end in a systems perspective. And maybe I'll pass back over to CJ on that, that systems thinking is a critical part of leadership to know what is the span and scope of this activity, the risks, and how do we challenge that?
Yeah, take it away, CJ.
Yeah, so, you know, talking about the systems architecture problem, we have got, we've got to get back to the basics here, Barbara, in thinking about how we address some of these problems. Because quite frankly, you know, simple things can cause complex consequences. Even what we're dealing with right now is a telltale sign of that right now. So, I mean, think about the, you know, earthquakes on land-based supply chains with regard to impacts. California has figured out their distribution network, or even looking at the supply chains and how people have this hoarding mindset just before a hurricane per se. So that also becomes an issue with regard to understanding how these things propagate and looking through, as John said, all of the different products that make up specific products. So it's that bigger picture thinking. So the it would be safe to say, you know, the Super Bowl Sunday mindset of pantry stuffing can't be supported indefinitely. There's only going to be so many products. And, you know, here stateside, you know, there's been some new policy created around the purchase of certain things with regard to returning products to Costco and Sam's Club. They're not allowing it because you're talking about potential, contamination issues. So that's a really important highlight because of the fact that's pretty unprecedented, because normally you were able to take stuff back to Sam's or Costco or, you know, your big box stores, but they are not allowing that as of now. So what are the unintended consequences of those actions too? So, you know, I would encourage all the listeners to get back to the basics and help the system kind of re-equalize by only buying what is needed. The toilet paper hoarding thing kind of bewilders me, but, you know, getting back to that point, it's something that folks can control, and it becomes a psychological type of exercise on being able to control certain items. But we're definitely seeing a multitude of dry goods being grabbed up very, very quickly and being able to create some equilibrium in the system, as I see a good thing, but we also need to consider the older populations that may not be able to, the older population demographics that may not be able to get out and buy at the level of frequency that we are currently consuming at. So that's a problem.
Those are really good points. I'm curious, John, about one thing that you mentioned. A food company that makes a decision to kind of scale back and focus on one or two of their products in order to best utilize the ingredients, you know, anticipating that there might be limitations on ingredient sourcing going forward. When you think about what the C-suite has to manage right now, keeping enough employees in the plant, there was a call with FDA, where someone asked, you know, we're trying to screen our employees before they come into the plant, but we can't get touchless thermometers. And FDA said, yeah, we know there's a shortage, and kind of left it at that. So there are so many things on the minds of the C-suite. Do you have any advice for folks in those positions, you know, what they really need to focus on right now? You know, you mentioned about decision making and how it has to be, you know, quick and operationalized. So what advice do you have for how they kind of get through all the other distractions right now to make those really hard decisions?
Well, I think it's very important that they narrow the scope of the issues. So there's products that, again, if I go back to triage, and trying to get the critical products out, I would defocus on, you know, making and distributing birthday candles, just to give a simple example, and focus on the things that are absolutely essential. So this is what the government is doing in British Columbia. They want food companies and retailers to tell them how much inventory of ingredients they have, pre-production, production, and post-production finished goods. Because this is one of the critical issues, is visibility into the supply chain. And I wrote an op-ed last week where I said, you know, in peacetime, we have all of these processes in place, and sometimes we have organizations in place, like the GS1 standards body, and they protect the antitrust issues in peacetime. But when we get into a wartime crisis, we still need to follow the same types of standards governance. We can still work at pace. We can still make fast decisions with less accuracy. within a framework of standards and governance, because when we get out the other side, we have to decommission some of the things that we've done. And I'll give an example. Making decisions in food service, you know, big companies like Cisco, they will have volume products that they'll be moving into restaurants. Now, restaurants are still operating as ghost kitchens, so no customers, but they're still making meals and delivering meals, which is fantastic. But there's still a glut of inventory that was intended for food service that's not going there. So the food service companies and the producers have this dilemma right now. How do you repackage that, and how do you get that back out into retail? Are there alternative ways of packaging or labeling those products? So this is where leadership comes in from the regulator as well. In times of, in a wartime, the regulations that got us to where we are today, that helps us to structure everything we do today and comply with regulations, we have to relax those. And this is where industry need to be able to work together. So competitors need to be able to collaborate to share inventory. So back to your point earlier about keeping workers on the shop floor, you may have a factory that has capacity for 100 tons per week, but they cannot get the inventory, whereas their competitor may have vital ingredients that could help them keep their factories producing at 100%. We call that generally capacity planning or capacity management. So there's many, many areas where we have to think differently, and the C-suite needs to actually think differently. In peacetime, we have antitrust. In wartime, we have to throw that out the window and figure out how we can collaborate together. So I think from the C-level perspective, that's the kind of guidance I would give. And I would congratulate some of the regulators for their leadership, because they're listening to the problems that industry have. They're listening to the constraints that they have. And one example, the Canadian regulator said, you know what, we have a labeling requirement where everything sold in Canada has to be bilingual, English and French. But if we're bringing in a product that's got no risk to a consumer's health and safety, like hand sanitizer, you know what, we can take that in from the US in English only. That makes sense. So again, going back to basics, how can we just simplify some of the things? And there, you know, I often say there's a rule of thumb, and I think I may have said this to a few people before. I look at things and I can focus on them for 7 nanoseconds, 7 seconds, 7 minutes, and 7 hours. There's many of these things that are 7 nanoseconds. We just need to do it and get it done. There's other ones that will take us 7 seconds. We need to just think. We have three options: adopt and go, pick one. 7 minutes is where you have to pull in a few more people. Again, if you want to work fast, you have to work alone, or you have to work in smaller teams to get things done. And for big ticket items where you need to collaborate, and that's where you may need to take 7 hours to sit down with your competitors and figure out how are we going to get out the other end of this. So in that context, C-level need to be cognizant of their supply chains. I did a radio broadcast last night, or I was a guest on a radio show, I should say, and I talked about this critical need for companies to expose the visibility. So back to what CJ was talking about earlier, we still do not have the capability to, in real time, to determine where are our products and in what state are they at. And I'll give you one example of where it's failing. And despite me calling out to people saying never ever throw away vegetables or fruit, make a shake or donate them or do something, make soup, in the last week alone, I've had to throw away 3 products within 2 days of buying them. I had blueberries that went completely moldy in the fridge. I had mushrooms that were completely moldy within 2 days, and I also had broccoli. Now, that tells me that the decisions that are being made within industry, rightly so, is to move volume product, but they may not be moved in the normal way, in a refrigerated truck from A to B. So these things are creeping in. We're going to see food waste. So we need to tighten up a little bit. We need to focus a little bit. And the C-level need to make critical decisions about what they should produce, in what volume, and if there are any risks to their people, and so on. And I finish on this one point. We're now exploring an idea in Canada here where we can do geomapping of a province. then we can do GPS coordinates of all of the factories that are producing food that are deemed essential services that need to be open. Then we're considering now, considering, we haven't done this yet, but we're considering mapping on top of that while protecting employees' privacy rights. We're asking the question, what if we could map the home postcode of the employees on top of that map, and then map the COVID-19 outbreak areas on top of that to see if we can learn from that? What can we learn from that? Do we have 50 employees in one critical factory that are in an area that's a hotspot? Are they a higher risk than the 70 employees that are in an area where there's no outbreak? So these are things, and I think technology will help us to do a better job in the future. We're not there yet. We still have a lot of work to do to figure these out.
You know, what you said, John, was a really great segue into kind of coming back to, you know, we've heard over and over that this disease is not transmitted through food or food packaging, that that it's really, you know, person-to-person contact right now as a respiratory illness. But are there food safety or food security risks that no one's really talking about? And you mentioned a little bit about the food security, having to throw away more food because perhaps as we're shuttling products around, maybe from a restaurant that now has had to shutter and they don't want things to go to waste and they're trying to figure out how to repackage and keep that food in the chain, that maybe cold chain is not being followed so that we have, you know, compromised issues with at least spoilage, if not food safety. So, CJ, what do you think in terms of, are there risks that to food safety that no one's really talking about that we at least need to be considering?
Yeah, so and to John's point, on a multitude of different levels, we need to look at, you know, some of the systems architecture, the human in the loop, the things that are necessary to kind of complete the food supply chain. The biggest thing is, you know, there could be folks that are coming across the border, migrants that are picking these crops that as a result of COVID-19 may not be able to do that. And then you get into spoilage in the fields of food. So now you truly have a supply issue, and the distribution network is going to be ultimately impacted because of that. No food, no distribution, you know, panic will ultimately start setting in. But to John's other point, being able to put up to digitize this or put it up in a visual narrative on how things move from point A to point B and all of the logistics logistics points all in between, we could definitely put into a digital type of narrative that I think would help folks in government, folks in the private sector and in industry kind of understand that they are a small piece of a very big pie. And being able to move that visualization forward, I think would get folks start thinking more systems wise on the, you know, the how and the why things get from farm to table. And we need to, again, I can't highlight this enough, we need to get back to basics to create clarity from a lot of complexity, not only from the decision-making process, but the education as well as understanding on how all these things function, because it's truly a system of systems, but it's also a very interconnected system as well. And there's a lot of folks that don't necessarily understand how they play a role in this supply chain of supply chains. So I think if we can start talking more about that, if we can start educating and informing and being able to do some data visualizations and being able to utilize data in a way that it potentially never has, I think that's going to create a multitude of opportunities for folks inside and outside the industry, for government regulators, for decision makers to be able to kind of articulate not only the complexities of the system, but a visualization as to how the system functions.
I would add to that, Barb, if I can.
Sure.
I think on both fronts we have risk. This has definitely been a significant wake-up call. So if I look at food safety first, the FDA are not sending their inspectors abroad. Companies are not sending their inspectors, their auditors abroad. And the companies that are abroad in many of the developing countries, because we have to remember our food chain is global, and even the US and Canada were highly dependent for certain commodities or categories on imported goods. So if people are affected in other countries that have less of flexibility in how they do things, we could have products coming in that are uninspected, not tested properly according to normal procedures, because I've been talking to laboratories around the world as well, and the laboratories are their staff are at home as well. Hopefully laboratories that cater for food safety testing, they should be, I believe, an essential service. And so one of the things coming out of this is, how do we look at the broad essential services? And one of the projects we did at APEC a number of years ago, Asia Pacific Economic Collaborations, 21 economies, was we looked at a vineyard. Now, I wasn't directly involved in this project, but a vineyard in Chile. And there was 70 different services needed to bring that product to market. 30 were done by the farmer, the grower. 20 were done partially internally, partially externally. And another 30 were done by a multitude of other parties. So we're not looking at the service component, which would include the food safety testing component. So I think we are at risk. Luckily enough, the supply chains are still open for most countries, but most countries will be looking at this very carefully. Is there a food security issue? And will they move into sovereignty mode and say, you know what, we're not shipping these products because we need to feed ourselves because we don't know how long that's going to go to. So we move from a food safety issue into food sovereignty, where we will have a risk to food security. And what CJ mentioned and I mentioned earlier about getting access to migrant workers is critical. And then you have, within food security, you have food loss and food waste. Food loss is in the pre-consumption phases, right from the farmer, the primary processor, through to where it's processed. If we can't seed and we can't grow and the farmer can't get all of these ancillary services that he needs to grow the crops, well, we don't have a food security issue. We have a massive global problem. It just gets exacerbated significantly. With the hoarding that consumers are doing right now, we're going to have, that's called a food waste when it gets into the consumer side, or when it's ready for consumption. The waste at the household level will naturally increase. I've seen it myself. I can't remember the last time I threw out a vegetable or a fruit, and I've done it three times in the past week. I hate doing that. It's very unfortunate, but I couldn't save them. And so we're going to have massive waste at the consumer side, unfortunately. In my op-ed last week, I've recommended to consumers that if you do think you have too much in your refrigerator, your pantry, to consider, certainly for the non-perishables, to donate them to food banks. In Toronto alone, last year, we had 1 million visitors to unique visits to food banks. And that's up 4% from the year before in a subsidiary of Toronto, Mississauga, around where the airport is. That was up about 14%. So we have to look after those in society who are struggling right now. Many of those people who go to the food banks are possibly day laborers that are out of work, and they're struggling. So we need to look at, again, a systems view of all of this. We don't want to be just discussing rich people's problems. We have to deal with all of society.
Right. You know, many things are going to change once we get out the other side. Although I'm not sure any of us can see the light at the end of the tunnel right now. But some things won't wait for the pandemic to be over. So we've talked about a few things that really need to take place right now. I'm sure CEOs of food companies never thought they'd have to be collaborating with their competitors. That's a completely different mindset from what they're, but these are unprecedented times. We've never seen anything like this on this scale. If each of you had to pick one thing that, if it was in your power to change right now, you know, to help us get through this, what would it be?
On my side, I would say that I would get all of the major, the C-levels from the major companies together and get them to signal to the market. I research and study signaling theory, basically communication. So when I see government officials up on a podium and they're shoulder to shoulder and they're signaling we need to be 6 feet apart, that signaling is very weak and it's a very poor attempt to do that. We also have politicians who are talking about food supply. Well, again, their signaling strength is weak because they have no responsibility or accountability for that unless they take it over in an emergency act. So I would say that the food industry, the C-level in the food industry need to get together and they need to talk with one voice out to consumers and give them the real story. The signaling strength from the industry is powerful. I don't believe that the industry is using it effectively. That's the one thing I would change. Get industry to calm the anxiety that consumers have today about products, about supply. We have just an imbalance in the supply chain, but generally we don't have a supply problem with any of the products out there. But that anxiety exists and we need to deal with that. It's not the right place for politicians to deal with it. Let's get the CEOs up on a podium together, 6 feet apart, and let them signal what the real issues are and what the challenges are.
Right. How about you, CJ?
I would echo John's sentiments as well. We have one of the best logistical supply chains in the world. We have some very smart people in the private sector, as well as some folks in government who really want to make, who are genuinely concerned about what's going on right now. We need to bring some folks in government and private sector and industry together who are subject matter experts to really understand the root cause of why things are happening the way that they are. Being able to provide insight and tacit level knowledge that normally isn't shared between organizations, I think is critically important, because John is absolutely right. We are in unprecedented times, and this is a whole of community systems approach that needs to be looked at. We need to start thinking differently about these problems. We need to start incorporating everybody at every level with regard to how these systems function, and look at some of these potential vulnerabilities, these cross-sector vulnerabilities, these single points of failure, looking at how infrastructure and getting academia and the NGOs involved too, because there are folks all over the country that want to help solve this problem. We have a very unique opportunity after all this is over to bring a whole of systems approach to some of these problems that have not only hindered the industry, but have hindered government, NGOs, industry for years and years, that I'm confident there are folks that are listening, that are going to be listening after this is all said and done. And, you know, business as usual is no longer going to be business as usual, because, you know, in a world economy, which we are ultimately dealing with right now, we are seeing the unintended consequences and how these supply chains are behaving, have been disrupted, and we need to change the way in which we think about these problems in a whole of systems context.
You know, it's interesting that both of you come back to communication and speaking with, you know, a clear voice to try and kind of tamp down the level of anxiety that exists right now. I know that we have seen in the past, pre-pandemic, some fatigue on the part of consumers with regard to, say, outbreak notices. I think in the era of social media and information on demand, it's very easy for people to really tune out the important information. So, John, what ideas do you have about how how a group could rise above kind of that din of all the information that's coming out and changing every day. We've never seen information change so quickly. How do we rise above and get that the science out there, the facts out there, to kind of deal with the level of anxiety we're seeing?
Yeah. And part of my research is also in the area, it's not only transparency, but it's also trust. Just as I'm speaking right now, I'm getting an emergency alert on my phone from the government warning everyone that's coming back into Canada to go immediately home and do not stop at a grocery store or beer store. That's just an alert on our phones, which is part of that emergency response. But I also research transparency and trust in the food chain. And transparency is very important and at many different levels. And when we talk about transparency, we have to talk about, and by the way, if any of the listeners are in a room with a person or a company that's talking about radical transparency, you have my permission to hit them with a wet noodle and leave the room. We shouldn't be talking about radical transparency when we don't understand what simple transparency is. And even on the East Coast and West Coast of the US and Canada, the transparency requirements will be different. So we really need to be transparent with the information that consumers need and consumers want and not be influenced by marketing. So marketing is part of the issue here, where they can create some noise and distortion in the message, certainly around food products. We have bad actors who make claims. We had an Asian doctor in Canada who was called on the mat yesterday for saying that he has tea that can make you immune to COVID-19. He was interviewed on TV, and he got slammed from his own community, from his profession, and he won't be doing that again. So we have bad actors like that, even professionals who are misleading consumers. And they're the people that we look up to in a crisis. We look up to doctors and we look up to people in authority. We also have issues in Canada where we have doctors that are hoarding or prescribing some of the medicines for their own family and friends, and that is an issue. So we have bad actors right across society, and this is why I made my recommendations in an op-ed over a week ago that the government needs to signal very clearly around issues like antitrust or price gouging, bid rigging, price fixing, and so on. They need to be cognizant of that and send out those strong signals that any abuses to the system will not be tolerated. Some governments have actually gone out and said, you know what, we're going to fine for misinformation. If anyone is putting out false or misleading information, we're going to catch them. And just yesterday, our federal police in Canada, they announced that we have, of course, aid programs in Canada, just like in the US, and there's people sending out phishing messages, directly into people's cell phones. You've just been allocated $1,700 by the Canadian government. Click on this link. And when they go to that link, it's a perfect image of the Canadian government. They have to fill in their bank details. So we have the criminals who are still quite active and playing on the vulnerabilities of consumers, even during this crisis. Now, luckily enough, we have very smart police forces north and south of the border. They're collaborating and sharing information on how these things occur, who's doing it. We have companies like the big tech companies who are managing some of these social media platforms. They're also engaged, and this is a perfect example of where all of these companies are collaborating with authorities to either delete, remove, and try to find out who are the criminals, who are the bad guys out there that are seeding distrust in the system. And on that point, transparency enhances trust. But as consumers, we automatically assign trust. When we go into a restaurant, we want to buy food, we trust that everybody worked in our interest. When you have a bad experience, that's mistrust. So mistrust is based on a bad experience. And when you have a bad experience with something, whether it's a food company or whether it's a retailer or whether it's a government, that will stick with you when you make another choice in the future. It's very hard to regain that trust. And then you have something that's caused by a lot of the misinformation, and that's distrust. Distrust is not the same as mistrust. It's about it's based on, it can be based on false information, but it builds up this suspicion. And that suspicion can be ungrounded, and we need to address those as much as possible. So it's a very hard topic to deal with. In most cases, we're dealing with something that's either observable or unobservable. And when we're dealing with things that are unobservable, like the production in a factory, if the CEO came on, CEO of a big food company came on the air and said, "We have no problem with food," I would accompany that message with something that's observable to show their factories, to show the people working, to show the operations. So then you take away that unobservability. And then in that way, that level of transparency can further enhance trust. So I think all of the good actors, and I know that good wins out over evil always. So we're getting better at doing these things. I would just say that all of the people who are doing a lot of really good work in identifying the bad actors right across society and on online, those people need to get, thank those people for what they're doing, and to the big companies for shutting them down as quick as possible.
Right. So as we wrap up today, I'd like to ask each of you if you have advice, because even though we're all, for the listeners who are intimately involved in the food industry, we're all consumers as well. So what advice do you each have for what we individually could do to decrease the pressures on the supply chain? With the exception of not going out and buying toilet paper right now, which at least in Massachusetts you can't find anyway. So let's start with you, CJ.
So, Barbara, this is a one team, one fight mentality. In the broader context of things, we need to leverage entities like Food Safety Magazine to amplify this message that we're talking about today, because you guys are really at the grassroots of all of this and making things. You're that interconnected network behind the scenes that's keeping it all together. We also need to think about the humanity of everyday life that everybody's experiencing right now. The grocery cart guy, who's struggling to feed his family. I want to thank the retail interface, the restaurant workers, the checkout workers, the critical infrastructure of the food and ag sector. It's not just the facilities. There's a human in the loop here, and these folks operate these systems, but they're the ones who are responsible for making this system's architecture work the way it was designed. We've got co-manufacturers and third-party manufacturers that are spread thin right now. I mean, we're all in this together. Foodborne illness doesn't take the pandemic off. Getting back to the basics involves ensuring we're still doing what needs to be done every day to keep the food supply safe. So again, this is a food safety and food defense thing, but it's also a systems architecture construct as well. But being able to understand how all of these things come together to make a whole of system construct is what is needed. It's long overdue, and we need to continue to engage in these conversations at some of the highest levels of the food industry so folks understand that these are not trivial things that we are trying to address here. There's a tremendous amount of complexity on a multitude of different levels. And, there's humanity behind all of this as well. So that would be my parting message for how we should proceed and kind of move this forward and educate and understand and absorb.
Great. Your thoughts, John?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think number one, we have to be kinder to each other. We have to realize that everyone has stress levels. We have medical professionals in the US and Canada and all around the world who are separated from their children, separated from their families, extended families. And these people are doing incredible work to keep us alive and keep us healthy and safe. So we need to be kinder with each other or to each other. And I would say, turn off the television. This is something that I do. I meter myself. I start my day at 4 a.m. So I start a little bit earlier than most people. And then I get a good run to about 8 a.m. on my own work. I had shut down social media for 3 months this year for other reasons for my research. And I just went back on 2 days ago just for a specific purpose. But last year and this year, January, February, and March, I shut down all social media completely, zero, nothing. And it's that social media sabbatical is absolutely fantastic. It's taking a digital vacation. So I think turn off the television, media yourself on the television. You know, if you're having a lunch and you want to watch it, then watch it for a half an hour, but be very cautious on what you're doing it and how you're doing it and what you're listening to. If you have children, I would say, you know, meter their access to media as well. And the final thing I would say is, if you do get, we are all getting hundreds of messages, WhatsApp messages, and so on. Again, I'm not on Twitter or any of those platforms, but think twice about re-forwarding some of those messages. Some of them are maybe culturally sensitive. Some of them may be language sensitive and so on. I would say think twice about re-forwarding those messages. Laugh at some of them, delete them, and move on. And let's try to keep the traffic down. In the past week, I've been on very important calls, and as we're all on very important calls, but my calls have dropped, and nearly every call has dropped because of bandwidth issues, I guess. I can only imagine it's bandwidth issues. So media yourself on the TV, relax on the social media. If you can take a social media sabbatical, please do. I can vouch for it now, 2 years in the trot. It is fantastic. Be kind to people and try to smile through this, because we'll come out of this stronger and better as societies. And we'll look back and we'll say, you know what, that was a good learning experience for us all. And there's a joke out there, if I may tell one joke, and the joke is about social distancing. And somebody said, well, just ask a couple who have been married for 7 years to tell you what social distancing is. That's my only joke, but it's a little bit of humor helps us in times of crisis. But we need to smile more, be kind to each other. And if you sing, sing. If you play music, play music.
Great words to wrap up this podcast by. Again, I want to thank both of you for joining me today. And thanks also for making time in your busy schedules to talk about this important topic.
Delighted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks again to John Keough and CJ Yunus for making the time on very short notice to join us for this important and informative discussion. We will continue to do all we can to keep you informed as this crisis unfolds. The most timely means that we have for this is our website, foodsafetymagazine.com, where you can find the results of a survey that we conducted, impacts of coronavirus on food processing and food safety, as well as a special news and resource section that's updated as new information becomes available. If you have any questions or suggestions, please email us at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com. And once again, we send our best wishes to all of our listeners around the world, and we thank you all for all that you're doing to ensure the safety of our essential food supply. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.